This is a special edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. We wrap up our candidate conversations from the Democratic primary for governor with Colin O'Mara. O'Mara is making his first run for office in Delaware, but previously served as DENREC's secretary under former governor Jack Markell. A reminder, the interviews you're hearing here on The Green are edited for time. Full candidate conversations are online at DelawarePublic.org. Do you have in your mind going in what may be a potential signature agenda item or items for you to pursue?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I do think that the most important thing is actually transforming our public schools. And it's really about equitable funding. It's about early pre-K. It's about making sure that we have universal school meals, better teacher pay and educator pay, making sure that we have better ratios. But I think education will be the kind of cornerstone. But we also need a massive conversation on affordability. You know, the fact that, you know, housing, healthcare, childcare are unaffordable in the state. So that'll be another signature piece. Environment obviously will always be for me. I think we could be the one of the national leaders on climate change and environmental justice and open space conservation. We got development kind of run amok in a whole bunch of places. And so, you know, making sure that that's a priority. And then the last one, and this may depend on kind of what happens at the federal level, but there is kind of a basic protection of fundamental rights, that things that I didn't think we'd have to be in the, you know, courts battling over, things that we'd have to, you know, put into our Constitution. But we can't take for granted anymore around reproductive rights, voting rights, civil rights, rights for sexual orientation and gender identity, rights for around the environment, rights around of criminal justice reform. I mean, there's a civil rights element, I think, that the next governor is going to have to play as well. But those are kind of the four areas that I see as absolutely central to the next administration.
And I do want to talk about a little bit of each of those as we go on. But before we do that, I do want to talk a little bit about the budget, because history tells us the next governor is going to face at least one economic downturn that leaves the state facing a revenue shortfall during their term. How would you approach such a situation to balance the budget if you wind up being down $300, $400, $500 million going into a budget cycle?
Yeah, no, I mean, I lived through this during the downturn of 2009. Mm-hmm. Governor Markell came in, and then, you know, $800 million shortfall within a few months of taking office with the new DFAC projections. Like, I think there's a couple things. I mean, there's obviously places that we can tighten our belt, and there's kind of reductions that can happen. At the same time, there's a whole bunch of investments that we need to make that have big returns in the long term and will save us money in the long term. You know, we still have a 1950s budget in a lot of ways where we're paying for the consequences of not having better schools, not having better healthcare outcomes, not having better community safety. And so, you know, I want to make sure that we're smart and really kind of transforming the way we think about the budget. You know, right now, if a legislator proposes, say, a new program, the way that that's evaluated in the legislature is they only look at the costs, but they don't look at the benefits. They don't look at the cost that it offsets. They don't look at the cost that it's going to save in the long term. And so if you actually start looking at some of those calculations, you make different budget decisions. And then at the end of the day, if we really diversify our economy the way that I hope to around clean energy, biopharmaceuticals, fintech, sustainable chemistry, I mean, there's a whole bunch of opportunities to create more jobs, to create more revenues, to be more predictable and more sustainable. So we're not in this kind of massive cycle of wondering what a sheet is and what, you know, what the what's coming out of some of the more less predictable revenue lines.
So you've talked about a number of different issues along the lines. So let's try to delve into a couple of them. We'll start with affordable housing. Where and how do you feel the state can be most effective at addressing it? And I guess maybe the broader question I'm trying to ask is this a big solution issue or a creating a toolbox of solutions type of issue?
Yeah, it's both.
Okay.
How's that for an unsatisfactory answer? political answer. No, look, I mean, our housing stock ownership has changed dramatically in the state over the last 30 years. We have a larger percentage of our home units that are owned by investors or like second homeowners than almost any other state in the region. And so when you have a lot of out-of-state folks that are buying up properties for renting them or you know, leasing them in different ways, it changes the economics. And so part of the affordability kind of challenge we face right now is folks are jacking up rents very, very high because they're just trying to maximize profit, mm-hmm. but they're not invested in the community. And so there are things we can do around that. There's some conversations around like rent stabilization and some things that they've done in many, many other states across the country. The second piece is that it's pretty hard to build affordable housing in the state. But if I want to build high density infill development near transit, you know, in Newcastle County or near the transit station on Route 1 down in the coastal communities in Sussex, it's incredibly hard. It's easier to build that massive subdivision on a farm field in the middle of, you know, nowhere with not a lot of infrastructure than it is to actually put dense units in where people live and where they work and where there's actual infrastructure and actual jobs. We need to make that easier. It's a different way of thinking about it, but I think at the end of the day, we need to make sure we're removing those government barriers, a lot of which are well-intended, to make it easier to build affordable housing. And it shouldn't be removed for everything, but it should be removed for things that have a public good. Because, you know, right now we're going to need 25,000 to 30,000 additional units. Mm-hmm. You know, we have the third or fourth highest rates of eviction and of foreclosures in the country. And so I think there is absolutely a need for a toolbox, but you're going to need a governor that's saying, look, we're going to go big, and we're going to say, like, if there's NIMBY decisions in some places that say, like, look, we're not going to allow affordable housing, there should probably be an override. So I just, like, there's this a crisis that statewide is going to require a statewide solution.
So let's talk a little bit about education. When we spoke in May, you did express support for the recommendation in the education funding report produced last fall after the education equity lawsuit for funding, calling for an additional $600 million to $1.1 billion of spending per year. In the wake of that, since we last talked, lawmakers did create a public education funding commission to look at the funding structure in the coming months. How much would you expect that group's findings to inform your approach, or do you feel like you have a vision right now that you would like to implement day one?
I want to make sure that the timeline matches, like, the politics, because my fear is that if the recommendations don't come out until October, all of a sudden those recommendations don't become before the General Assembly until an election year. And my worry is that, you know, in an election year, folks are going to be hesitant to raise taxes. I really think this has to be a centerpiece of the first year agenda, and the very first year of the General Assembly. So I want to work with them. The way they've designed it is absolutely brilliant. The composition of the partners and kind of who's at the table, I think, is really well balanced. I just want to make sure we're moving those recommendations up as soon as possible, so there's a chance to vote on the recommendations before next June 30th.
And when we talk about education funding and equity, I believe when we talked last time, you had suggested that you're not necessarily interested in scrapping the unit count, but trying to find a way to build on it and change it in terms of things like weighted funding and making it different than the kind of antiquated system that it is right now.
Yeah, exactly. Correct? So if you look at the report, I think it's like page 150-something, there's a table that looks at kind of the shortfalls for each school district. And the thing that's amazing to me, unlike a lot of schools, and I was talking to one of the consultants that helped write the report, usually there's some places that are well overfunded, a lot of places are underfunded. In Delaware, everyone was underfunded based on the formula. So you can actually keep the unit count completely consistent and then have an additional pot. It's kind of a foundation, if you will, that then is distributed based on the equity formula, based on the needs of the students. And that puts us in a position where no one feels like they're losing. Because I do worry about, you know, folks feeling, oh, well, you're taking this from us. And if you do it the right way where folks don't feel like they're losing anything, but they're actually like everything's getting better, then all of a sudden there's more buy-in. And I think, you know, one of the things we have to realize too is that because of our antiquated system of property taxes that's actually going through changes right now, some of the wealthier properties in the state are actually properties that aren't owned by residents in the state. And so, you know, as those revenues come in, that helps defray the impact on other year-round residents that you know, otherwise would see increases. And so, you know, I'm really excited because I just think these conversations are finally converging, and you have political leadership in both the House and the Senate and, you know, kind of the committees and appropriations that are willing to make this a top priority. I think the crisis has reached such a tipping point in education that the next governor has to be willing to lose re-election and do the right thing.
I want to move on to healthcare, specifically cost and access, which are becoming really stubborn issues. Delaware has one of the highest costs of care in the nation while struggling to attract and retain providers and specialists. What would you advocate in terms of prioritizing addressing the issues of cost and access in healthcare?
Yeah, I mean, right now, I mean, up and down the state, I mean, I hear this everywhere, right? Where there's just insufficient, you know, the costs are too high, but also the access issue is such a big issue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was told by some folks down in Sussex that, you know, BB and Bay Health are actually reducing some of the maternal intake kind of capacity. So obviously, it's kind of devastating sort of thing, you know, kind of outcomes for children. And the big problem is that, like, we do have a culture that we've kind of set up over many years that rewards kind of consolidation and prevents any kind of competition. Like, I think we have to open up the market a little bit. And, you know, we have something called a certificate of need, that, you know, kind of requirement that you have to basically show that there's a need for whatever service is being added. It was a way to kind of control costs in the 1970s. It hasn't kind of borne out that way. Most states have already, the federal government had it for a little while. They got rid of it. Most states have gotten rid of it. We haven't yet. And what it does is two things. One is that you have to ask to add, but you don't have to ask to reduce. And so all of a sudden, there's nothing saying, oh, no, we need that service, even if it requires additional public support to provide it. And if an outside provider wants to come into the market, the incumbents can kind of say, oh, no, we already got that covered. What that does, like, I mean, not to sound like an economics professor, but anytime you constrain the supply and the demand is increasing, prices are going to go up, right? I mean, it's just the nature of kind of inefficient bureaucracies. On top of that, we created some state level incentives in 2012 that basically made it easier to consolidate for the nonprofit hospitals, but didn't give the same benefit to some of the for-profit providers. With all that in the backdrop, I mean, I just think the real big conversation we have to have right now is kind of starting with the outcomes. And I had a great conversation with kind of the mobilization groups the other day. That are trying to think of a kind of community-led health. And the inequities kind of even block to block, right? Mm-hmm. Folks not being able to get to general practitioners, right? Folks not being able to get to, you know, specialists. It just requires an entirely new assessment. And I'll give, you know, Matt Meyer's been talking about the medical school. I think like, long-term, I think that's interesting. I mean, I think it's, you know, how you get there. I mean, the states that have done it, it's taken a few years. I think we got to buy doctors now. Let's go out and find the best and brightest. I mean, for $20 million over a handful of years, you could attract some of the most talented folks in the country that if they spent 5, 6, 10 years here, they may spend a career here. BB's got a program right now for like a residency. They're trying to figure out like how to have housing on campus because mm-hmm. Folks can't afford housing in Lewis. Right. But I think we're going to have to attract people actively, and we can't just hope the market clears because it's just not going to without an active government.
I want to talk a little bit about climate. Obviously, the state has taken some steps to address climate change. Climate Change Solutions Act calling for the zero net additions of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere by 2050. There's the Advanced Clean Cars 2 program calling for 82% of new cars and trucks sent to Delaware for sale be zero emission by 2032. Also, some initial steps toward procuring offshore wind energy. I know you support all those things, but what do you say to those who are balking at these efforts, bemoaning mandates, government overreach, and things like that?
Yeah, I think Delaware is kind of uniquely vulnerable to climate impacts. And we have to lead, right? Because folks will say like, oh, it doesn't matter what we do here because they build one coal plant in China, then that offsets mm-hmm. the emissions that you can save in Delaware. The problem is that if everyone has that attitude, we end up with this like kind of race to the bottom that we're kind of on now. You know, we're nowhere near where we need to be to even meet the 2030 targets, let alone the 2050 targets. I want to make the case that it's in our economic interest. You know, we made a very significant shift from, you know, getting away from coal when I was secretary, and that's actually lowered prices overall because of renewables and you know, some of the gas we still have online is cheaper than the coal that we replaced. And other places that are still dependent on coal are seeing massive increases in their energy prices. We haven't had that here. I think we got to make sure that things like offshore wind and solar and other technologies are cheaper than the market. We can do that. If you amortize the cost over the lifetime, then it absolutely is. You know, we're in a position right now because of the incentives that I was fortunate to be able to work with the president on for the Inflation Reduction Act that, you know, we can get the kind of levelized cost of clean energy cheaper than fossil fuels right now at scale and do that in a big way. So it lowers our prices, creates a bunch of local jobs, and also helps fight climate change simultaneously. As a corollary, there's also huge opportunities for us in like the green hydrogen space. One of the things that I want to be careful of, though, is that I do think we have to bring people along with us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have, you know, kind of raised some concerns about the way that the Clean Cars 2 kind of standard is set. We're going to be required under that standard to have 43% of the vehicles that are introduced in Delaware for sale in the fall of 2026 for model year 2027 BEVs. It doesn't just like kind of go to 2032 and then kind of jump up. Mm-hmm. There's like this annual ramp.
Right.
We're less than 10% sales right now. And so the question is, like, how do we kind of revisit that and simultaneously make sure that we're actually putting the incentives in place that folks want to buy them? I'm very worried right now that, like, I don't want to see them as, like, Democratic cars. Folks should want them because they're cheaper. You don't have to go to the gas station anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, just the headache of not having to go to the gas station every 300 miles or 200 miles. They're cheaper to operate. There's an upfront cost difference. There's an affordability issue for lower-income folks that, you know, can't afford that $25,000 EV. But I want to make sure that folks are choosing voluntarily to buy them, not feeling like it's being forced on them. Because I don't want them to resent their vehicle. It's not a mandate the way it's written, but it feels that way to people. Mm-hmm. If folks feel forced, they're going to resent it for a generation.
In a time when there seems to be stronger distrust of government, calls for more transparency and accountability, what role do you feel the governor's office and you personally can play in giving people a sense that they're getting greater transparency and accountability from their government?
I think we need to overhaul the system. I think it starts with the campaign finance system here. I mean, the number of holes in the system, you know, the role of like developers buying, you know, votes on county council or on, you know, in Sussex or in Newcastle, the role of lobbyists on the floor and like the Delaware General Assembly. I mean, there's just the amount of perceived pay-to-play action in the state is killing us right now. And if you look at places that have seen Republican governors win in Democratic states, it's places where the corruption argument kind of took hold. And so, you know, I think for the governor, I think a lot more transparency. I think obviously the money in politics. I mean, I'd love to move to a system of more public financing like they have in Maine and Arizona and Connecticut and Maryland and a lot of other places across the country. We can do that very low cost. I mean, it'd be, I don't know, 0.03% of like the state budget and actually have a robust program to get a lot of the money out of government, out of politics. I think there's also distrust from the lack of transparency. And this is another area where, you know, the way the FOIA has been interpreted, the Freedom of Information Act has been interpreted in Delaware is very, very narrow. My motto at DENREC was basically just give them everything, right? Like, let them have it. And if we made a mistake, own up to it and move on. But, you know, like I do think that the Fourth Estate has an incredibly important role to play. I think citizens have a right to data about the health of their community. With all the new digital tools and some of the AI tools, I mean, the ability to get information out quickly so you don't have to have, you know, lawyers poring over things for days is going to be much easier. But I just think we need to go full, absolutely full transparency, you know, kind of across the board if we're going to restore confidence in state government.
There is obviously this idea that's been out there for a while now of an inspector general for Delaware. Would you support
100%, something like that? Yeah, I actually think that's a great example of something that should have gotten done this legislative session. It had the votes. It just gives people confidence. But, I mean, if we had an inspector general, you know, maybe some of the scandals of the Department of Labor would have been uncovered earlier. I just think it was such a no-brainer, right? And the fact that it first, given some of the things we funded in the budget last year, the fact that that fell out, I think is just another failure of leadership.
That's Democratic candidate for governor Colin O'Mara. Our full conversation with him is available at DelawarePublic.org. And that's a wrap on this special edition of The Green. The interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, our candidate conversations producers, Ethan Grandin, Jeep Hanslett, and Robert Stice, and Delaware Public Media senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again this Friday on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.